for doing that. That's great.
So this is going to be recording. You don't mind? Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us today. Please continue snacking, eating. There's some more beverages in the back, definitely. I just want to thank you all for joining us today. My name is Jose Barzola. I'm currently the president for Conflict Resolution Alliance. There's a little pamphlet and some information over there to give you a little more information about the organization. Thank you. Some quick housekeeping items. This is probably the most important portion of my talk. Restroom locations. Right across the hall are the women's restrooms. Take a left. Men's restrooms are back over near the reception desk where you first got out of the elevator. Then you got to look right. And then light refreshments and water. Done. Checked. So today's event is brought to you by the Hawaii State Bar Association, the ADR section. So thank you for you all who are here in the room. The Mediation Center of the Pacific, Center for Alternative Dispute Resolution, the Matsunaga Institute for Peace and Conflict Resolution, and the Conflict Resolution Alliance. And then I also want to just do a special thank you to Tricia Morris, as this was her vision that she brought to us, and it would not have been possible without her, so thank you so much. And without further ado, I want to introduce Lisa Jacobs, who will be introducing our main speaker, Ron.
Hello.
And Lisa handled all the nitty-gritty details, so thank you so much.
Oh, thanks.
And that was definitely under 2 minutes.
All right. Well, I would like to introduce our speaker, Ron Owsky, this afternoon. Ron is a leading family law practitioner who has, over the course of the past 35 years, worked in, studied, and written about the changing dynamics, particularly in the area of family law. He was among the first family law attorneys trained as a mediator in Minnesota. He's developed one of the most successful collaborative practices in the world and has co-authored a groundbreaking book with Stu Webb, who is the founder of Collaborative Law, and I notice I have the book also, and I notice the book is right here. So Ron is co-authored that. Was that in 2007?
2006.
Ron has done workshops and has written articles with Woody Mostyn, who's the father of unbundling, and he's actually a mentor of mine. Ron and I at back-to-back worked as Woody Mostyn's co-trainer in a divorce mediation course he offers in Southern California. So he has written articles with Woody Mostyn, the father of unbundling, and he has co-founded one of the largest interdisciplinary family conflict centers in the world in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, right? Yes. And has been a practitioner and an observer of a rapidly changing court system in Minnesota since 1983. In the year 2015, Ron was the sole individual to be awarded the Lawyer as Problem Solver Award by the American Bar Association. Ron has had the opportunity to speak at many events and forums on the topic of collaborative law and has conducted training seminars throughout North America, South America, and Europe. And so that's why, of course, we're so pleased to have him here. I'm not quite done yet. He's written numerous articles on conflict resolution and now focuses his practice and his teachings on helping particularly family law practitioners adapt to the changing legal world. And I know that we have, in addition to family law practitioners, we have practitioners in other fields of law, in business law, contracts, kind of trust dispute, and even patent law. So we have a nice variety of people, of attorneys here in various practice areas. We're really excited to have all of you here and learn from Ron. Ron graduated with honors from the University of Minnesota Law School and currently lives and practices in Edina, Minnesota. So please welcome.
Aloha. Thank you, Lisa, for those kind words, and thank you all for having me here. I'm so honored to be here. I'm grateful for the Hawaii State Bar Association and for Tricia, Lisa, and Tom and Jose for being such wonderful hosts. I've just been treated so wonderfully here. It's very humbling and very grateful to be here. It was helpful for me to listen to the biography to remind myself that there's a reason for me to be here, so that I have something to impart that's even more important perhaps than where the restroom is, although I don't know, we'll see. I have spent much of the last 40 years really looking at and observing and being around the changing legal climate, especially in the ADR world. It's been very exciting, and I've been very, very fortunate to be around great mentors and people that have helped me helped me in those areas. And I before I was a lawyer, I thought about becoming a journalist. And I think I still, in some ways, am the journalist of the legal profession, in the sense I'd like to observe and describe to people what I'm seeing. And this topic interests me immensely, talking about the 40 years of change in our society and in the legal system, because I have, if nothing else, been somebody who's devoted my career to observing and understanding what is happening. And I'm hoping to give you just a little bit of that history, but spend more time talking about what does that mean to us today? Where are we at today in our changing world? And how does that matter for you? And how can you be part of that changing world? Because I think we live in an enormously exciting time. And I think the opportunities are going to be unfolding before us. And if I can just plant even one seed in your mind that helps you be part of those better ideas, I will be grateful for that. So with that in mind, what the areas that I'm going to talk about, before I talk about the changes in the legal world, I wanted to just take a moment and just take note of what the last 40 years have been in terms of the changes of our world in general, with the internet and the advance of computers and cell phones. And we have lived in an astonishing time. And I know, as I say that almost every almost 63-year-old like myself looks back in the last 40 years and says, oh my goodness, what a great number of changes we had. But I think historians will say that the last 40 years are significantly different than almost anything we've seen, certainly in terms of information. I remember the economist Lester Thoreau, I heard him talk years ago about how there are some periods of time in the history of the world in which there can be very little change over 1,000 years, and suddenly in 40 or 50 years, things change more rapidly than they did in the past 1,000 years. And the example that's often given is that when you look at transportation, how long it took people to get from one city to the next city, it changed very little from the time of Julius Caesar till the time of Napoleon, about 1,800 years, and its speed of travel was about the same. In fact, some would argue you could travel more quickly in Roman times because they had better roads, but it didn't change. And suddenly you get the invention of the steam engine and the locomotives and automobiles and planes, and suddenly within 100 years, people were going everywhere in lightning speed. They lived at a time of change that was transformative. For many people, I think the time that we're living in right now with information exchange is equally astonishing, and there are good and bad elements of that. I also resist the notion that people look back and say, well, these were the good old days, things are worse today. I think something's better and something's worse in what we go through, and so it's not so much a matter of saying whether we're better off or worse off, but rather saying, okay, how do we adapt to this change in a way that we can use the very best of it? And that change has given us a backdrop to what we as lawyers and legal professionals, conflict resolution professionals, are going to be doing going forward. And those changes have affected us dramatically. In fact, one of the things that I remember in the same economist Lester Thoreau talking about is that in the information age, where information is now cheap, it's at our fingertips, not always reliable, but it's all there, that those of us who are in the business of disseminating information and selling information are going to have a hard time making a living. And lawyers, to some degree, 40 years ago, 50 years ago or more, we're in the business of selling information. We had the secret stuff that nobody had. Nobody saw the statutes or the will forms or any of those things. We had all the secret stuff, and people would pay us a lot of money just to get at that stuff. Well, that still exists to a degree, but a far less degree than it did 40 or 50 years ago, and it's probably going to be less and less as time goes forward. And so if they're not going to pay us for the information we have, what are they going to pay us for? And part of it is the one thing that so far no one has figured out how to quantify or digitalize is a sense of judgment, exercising good judgment, helping people in all of our professions think about the important, how that information they're getting can be used to allow them to make decisions in their work or in their family life and other areas. And so I say that as a backdrop as I look at ADR, because a lot of what ADR is now is shifting our legal model to one in which we are people who can help folks exercise judgment on their behalf. Now, I've given talk about the changing legal climate many other times, mostly in the area of family law, because that's where most of my work has been. I'm aware that in this community, in this group, we're lucky to have people doing a whole variety of areas. And so while some of my examples will be in the area of family law, I'm hoping that what I have to say has comparable application in all these areas of law, and I really think that it does. And so I'll keep that in mind as I discuss these things. But when we look at the things that are different 40 years ago, in the past 40 years in the legal world, and these are the 8 or 9 items that I think stand out the most, and I'll talk more specifically about some of them, how they evolved, and what they mean going forward. But obviously, starting with ADR, the notion of ADR, alternate dispute resolution, the cornerstone of this group, was talked about a little bit before the 70s, but very little. You find it in bits and pieces of literature, but was not part of our common language, and of course it is now all around the world. The notion of neutrals within our legal system existed a bit, but usually more in a court setting. Very, very little deductive neutrals. Now there's hardly any area of law that's not rich with neutrals. Now, interestingly, part of what I'll talk about is while there's been this enormous rise of neutrals throughout the world, the notion of advocates, aligned professionals, lawyers, the image of that has gone way, way down, and that's been a rapid shift. Some communities, certainly in divorce law, for example, they're seeing 70 or 80% of people self-represented. They've given up on lawyers. Sometimes people with enormous wealth have given up on advocates. So they've shifted to neutrals, saying, well, we'll trust neutrals, but we don't trust the aligned professionals. We don't trust the attorneys. And I, while I think, to some degree, many lawyers have worked long and hard to earn that distrust, I get that. but I think there are many people in this room who are worthy of the trust, and I think good lawyers doing the right thing. I am not anti-lawyer by any event. I spend a lot of my time trying to help people understand how they can work with lawyers differently. But I think working with lawyers as true healers, true conflict resolution specialists, is a wonderful thing. And so part of what we'll talk about is the revival of what is, in this changing world, what is the role of the aligned professional, somebody aligned with one party or the other versus the neutrals. The other great innovation is the multidisciplinary or interdisciplinary, the idea that in many of our areas, certainly in family law, but in other areas as well, it is no longer the sole jurisdiction of the legal people. Most areas of law now are working with interdisciplinary folks, either in finance, mental health, or a variety of others. Certainly in the divorce world, working with mental health professionals, working with financial people is part of what people have now come to demand. But we're finding that teams of interdisciplinary professionals are appearing throughout our landscape, and that's been another significant change. As I mentioned, the other one is self-representation. Self-representation is growing all over the world. To some degree, you know, most of our counties and states have developed good forms and ideas and ways for people to help themselves, which is good. At the same time, some of the people need the support and access to justice that they can get through counsel. So trying to balance that wave of self-representation and giving people efficient resources to supplement that is part of the new challenge. The other piece, of course, is technology. I mean, the speed at which things travel, the speed at which we can gather documents, electronic filing, word processing, all that has changed what is happening. We are now moving from the boomer generation that we serve to the millennials, and the millennials understand technology far better than most folks my age do. And they're going to insist on different ways of gathering information, different ways of processing. And so the technology has changed the way we as legal professionals interact with people. The other piece worth noting is, and I'll talk more about this as we go along, is the idea of interest-based negotiation, which I assume, how many people are familiar with what I mean by interest-based negotiation? So I assume that there's some familiarity there. I'll talk a little bit more about it as we go along, but I think that's one of the great ideas that came out of the 20th century, initially from the Harvard Negotiation Project and a book called Getting to Yes, and it has evolved in different forms and is used a lot in family law negotiation, but in other negotiations and mediations as well. I think that the rise of interest-based negotiation has been a big part of our political landscape. And then the court reforms that Lisa touched on. Even though I've worked mostly out of court the last 20 years, I spent the first 15 years of my practice doing traditional things, and I was in and out of court. But I've been observing court enough to know that courts, certainly in family law and other areas, have changed, and they're much more reform-oriented, much more likely to refer people to ADR resources. And so while court is still something we're increasingly seeing as a last resort, we're trying to change our court models to make them more responsive to the needs of the public. And then finally, there's the thing I will talk about, which is unbundled legal services, which is a really rapidly growing concept of law. I have an associate who was working with me who just came out of law school, and she said, boy, everybody was really talking in her textbook about unbundled legal services. And I think as we look at the millennials who are more discerning consumers, there are going to be more discussion of unbundling. And I'll explain, for those of you who aren't familiar with unbundling, I'll explain a bit more what I mean by that. But I just wanted to check that off as a list of among the things that have been changing. And so those are the main areas. Now the areas that I want to, before I get into what impact they're having on each of us today and where I think the future lies, I want to back it up a little bit and talk a little bit about the history of these, of four of those areas. And first I want to talk a little bit about the rise of the neutrals, because that's probably by far the most significant change. If you look at a legal community 40 years from now from today, the number of neutrals involved in our legal work is exploded. And I remember, and of course, when I talk about neutrals, the centerpiece of that is mediation. And when mediation just began, nobody was quite sure where it was going. And there were a number of people in our community, and I'm sure in your community here, who set out to make a living as mediators. We thought they would go broke. We didn't think anybody could make a living as a neutral person, as a mediator. Of course, now they're finding many people with very, very healthy mediation practices, and mediation has grown leaps and bounds. Now, what I think needs to happen as this mediation world emerges is more clarity about what it is and what the differences are, because it's a term that has been so broad that most mediators get frustrated with that, because it can describe everything from, on one end of the continuum, a very transformative or facilitative model where the mediator is there just sort of guiding people in the gentlest way, to a very evaluative model, or a former judge is leaning on people 1 month before trial telling them they better settle or you're going to get, the judge is going to rule against you. All those things come under the label of a mediation, but they're all very different looking process. And I'm not necessarily cursing either one of them, except that you get different outcomes at this end of the continuum than you get at the other end of the continuum. And the other main different element is that you have mediations in which lawyers are very involved and mediations in which lawyers are not involved at all. You're operating without representation. And they're very, very different processes. And the key is not to say that one is good and one is awful, but to help clients understand, when we say let's consider mediation, there's a lot of different things to talk about. What does mediation look like? And that term is being used to describe a lot of different process choices, and we need to get better at providing clarity for people about what it means to have a mediator and what that's going to look like in your process. Now, the one common feature when I talk about a mediator as a neutral, I'm talking about a person or persons, I realize mediators sometimes work in teams, who are going to work with you through some process that is fully confidential and inadmissible. That's the one common term. All mediators, if it's going to be called mediation, are going to create something in which they can't testify unless it's part of a signed agreement, and so people are operating in an inadmissible process. Now, that's the main form of neutral work happening in most of our things, is mediator and inadmissible process. Now, as you move up the continuum, there are neutrals who do evaluative type work that is admissible. You know, for example, in a divorce case, a financial person who might make recommendations to help you settle as a neutral, but if you don't settle, they're going to testify to the judge, or at least they're available to testify, and that has a different feel. Again, pros and cons, but it's a different kind of neutral, all the way up to the continuum to people, neutrals that create binding opinions, arbitrators, consensual special magistrates, people that can do different things as neutrals. Again, mostly I think the important thing is to look at the clarity when we talk about neutrals. We talk about the mediators and a whole range of services that they provide, and getting clarity about how people mediate to neutrals that can have binding, that can testify to neutrals that can be binding. And in family law cases, we see them all across the board with financial issues, with parenting issues. We see mediators and neutrals used in all three of those areas. The other thing that's happening different to neutrals is that it's no longer the lawyers who are playing the role of the neutrals. Again, early on in mediation, it was predominantly the lawyers who stepped up as mediators. And now we're seeing, while there are quite a number of lawyers and mediators, we see financial people as mediators. Is Tricia here? We have a wonderful number of people that mental health professionals that are good mediators. We have business people, a lot of people beyond the legal profession. And some of them operate as generalist mediators, mediating the entire issue. Sometimes they operate as specialist mediators. Like in a family law case, we might have somebody who really mediates the parenting issues, who's really called a child specialist or a family mediator in that regard, and sometimes a financial specialist who's mediating just the financial issues. We have this whole subpart of mediation specialists as well. And so the roles of the neutrals as it's emerged is all over the board, and it's wonderful because it creates a lot of tools for us to create a truly client-centered process. But I think right now it's a little bit confusing, and there's a little bit of infighting about different ways that neutrals operate, and mediators suffered from the same thing that, and I'll talk a little bit about collaborative here in a bit, that sometimes there became sort of infighting between mediation processes. My process is better than yours. Why don't you do it my way? I've got a set of orthodoxy. I've got a way that I mediate. And we wound up with a lot of division sometimes among mediation and mediation groups. Nothing wrong with differences of opinions. In fact, having clarity about the different ways to mediate is a healthy thing. But I think it's more about, from my view, putting out information out there about the different mediation styles. What style works well in one area? What style works well in the other? We have a mediator in Minnesota who's one of the best transformative mediators in the world. And he's very, very good, but he does not assume anything when the clients come to the table. He does a lot of divorce work. He doesn't even assume they want a divorce, assume anything. He will move ever so gently and help them reach their own conclusions. For people that want that and negate that, it's a wonderful process, but it's a relatively small group of people who can do that. Now, he becomes quite adamant about downplaying the other styles of mediation, such as the big rise in Minnesota lately has been more towards evaluative mediation. What we call early neutral evaluations. In fact, in Minnesota now, one of the changes in the court system, which is mostly an improvement, is that when you file a divorce case for now, you almost immediately get sent to an early neutral evaluator. Some neutral person who's going to tell you what they think a judge might do with your case. Now, it helps settle a lot of cases. It avoids a lot of our temporary hearings. In some ways, it's an improvement over the old way. However, in my view, giving people evaluative information too quickly still can be settlement by threat. I mean, what we really want in a lot of cases, especially within family law, is that if people settling based on the interests and things that they hold at the highest level, telling them to settle simply because the judge will order otherwise sometimes leaves some people short. So I think moving to evaluative too soon can be a problem. But it's something that people need to weigh when they're talking about mediation. When we're talking about mediation, what kind of mediation is appropriate? Now, so far all we've talked about is the role of the neutrals. And I really want to talk about now the next piece, which is the role of what I call the aligned professionals. I mean the attorneys, advocates. You can use a lot of different terms. But that's been the area that has, if anything, has sort of shrunk, certainly within family law and in some areas. People are really wondering. Where early on, there was a lot of concern about how expensive litigation is, and there still is. I mean, people are really trying to avoid litigation. That's out there. People know litigation's way too expensive, way too acrimonious. But the pendulum swung around. They're saying, well, yes, if we don't need the lawyers for litigation, what do we need them for? Why are they here? What is their relevance? And I think there is a whole new level of saying, okay, what kind of advocacy is relevant in this new era? There have been a lot of reforms in the last 40 years trying to elevate the idea of advocacy, trying to look at, to reframe the idea of what an advocate might look like, because the public has the worst idea of advocate. If you talk to the average person about what it means to be an attorney or an advocate, you hear all sorts of horror stories. If I had a flip chart in front of you saying, okay, what do people think about with advocate, I could put up all sorts of words up there. You'd hear that are the nastiest of words. People have a bad idea of lawyers and advocates, which is unfortunate in something, especially is that I know a lot of many, many good and honorable lawyers who do great work and are there as legal counsel, but that notion has been lost. Of all the movements that have been out there to try to reform that, only one has introduced a concrete piece to the ADR continuum. And this is where I want to talk about collaborative law, and, because it's something that I know exists in Hawaii. I've met two wonderful collaborative lawyers. You've got good collaborative professionals in your community. But just as in Minnesota, it's widely unknown by a lot of folks, and particularly outside of family law. And yeah, I think the next wave of collaborative practice may be outside of family law. But it is something that is, I've had the amazing privilege to observe from its very onset. About 30 years ago, a guy named Stu Webb was practicing in Minnesota, a very brilliant man, graduated number one in his class at University of Iowa, really well-respected lawyer, but reached a point where he was just frustrated. He was working in family law, was frustrated, as many of us were, about how we were doing things. And he came up with an idea that is so simple that it's easy to miss the profound nature of it. His idea was that what if we created a system in which the lawyers would agree in writing to withdraw if the matter went to court. The lawyers would agree in writing to withdraw if the matter went to court. What might that do? Might that cause the lawyers to behave differently? Might that cause the clients to behave differently? Might that cause a new way of thinking about how lawyers operate? And he wrote a letter to Sandy Keith, one of his friends who was a justice of the Supreme Court, on February 14th, 1990, almost 30 years ago to this day, saying, well, what do you think? What might happen? Because what he said is that we've all had cases in which, boy, the other counsel behaved a certain way that was good, and the parties behaved a certain way, and you left the case saying, boy, this is what I went to law school for. This is the way I think settlement handling a case should happen. He said, what about if we take what happens accidentally once in a while and try to make it happen deliberately? And so the idea of the withdrawal agreement, the idea that the lawyers would have to withdraw, was his cornerstone. Well, 30 years later, and Stu Webb, if you met him, I wish I'd him here, he's not a marketing genius. He's not a guy that went out and tried, all he did was go out and find three or four people and say, okay, I've got this idea, you want to do this with me. 30 years later, that method's being done in 27 different countries and 5 different continents all over the world because of that one little tiny piece, the idea that what would happen if lawyers withdraw? Now, the fact that lawyers withdraw is the cornerstone. That's the one defining piece. That's still the most controversial piece. I mean, if you talk to many of my friends and colleagues who don't do collaborative practice in Minnesota, they tell you that's a crazy piece. Why would you have to, so lawyers have to withdraw? That makes no sense, and blah, blah, blah. If you talk to those of us who've been doing collaborative law for a long time, that's the genius of it. Now, interestingly, if you talk to anybody, any lawyer who's done, I would say, at least 50 to 100 cases in both methods, both systems, a system where the lawyers would have to withdraw and a system where they won't, they almost universally, I would say 98%, would say there's a better environment. It's kind of counterintuitive. You think, well, why would I have to be in a position to withdraw? How would it do that? Well, the idea is that it would create a different environment. We would step out of the shadow of the courthouse long enough to start thinking about the problem differently. And that's exactly what happened, is that the lawyers were sort of forced to think about the problem differently. Well, one of the things that happened early on with that is that they started to realize how important it was to have an interdisciplinary approach. And there were some people in California who were doing divorce law really without lawyers. They would have two coaches, a coach for husband, a coach for wife, a child specialist for the children, and a financial for the finances. And they were working on their own. They would just find lawyers at the end to draft the paperwork. Well, they heard about collaborative law, and it was a perfect marriage. And so collaborative law, Stu's idea of lawyers withdrawing, connected with a team, and it became collaborative team divorce. So you have two really kind of great ideas. One is that the lawyers are involved for settlement purposes only, and then you have the idea of an interdisciplinary approach. And that was kind of what led to the big explosion. And again, particularly in family law, but I know it applies in some of your other areas, it's obvious to our clients and our consumers that a big part of the problem isn't legal, isn't just legal. I would say on a divorce case, maybe 30% of it is legal. A bigger chunk of it is financial and parenting and communication. And I've got ideas about all those things, but there are people that are better at it than me. And so getting a team approach, getting an interdisciplinary team to work with our clients helps them get better outcomes. And so collaborative law met collaborative team, the teaming, and we had created collaborative team divorce. And that's most of what is going around the world. Now, what has happened within that is it's become interdisciplinary. And this is the same thing, remember I mentioned with mediation, sometimes people got locked into a certain way of doing things, is that as we started to evolve teams in the divorce world, the initial model was husband hires a team, wife has a husband hires a coach, wife hires a coach, they both hire a child specialist if they're children, they have a financial neutral, they hire two lawyers. Now you can see all the wheels working, you can say, what's wrong with this picture? Well, a lot of my clients aren't going to be thrilled about hiring six professionals. Now, some will, and again, people do a lot of team divorce, say, boy, you know, it's worth it, they save money, and this and that, but the reality is not everybody can hire six professionals. And so we got a little bit stuck on the idea of the full team in every case, And then we started to evolve it a little bit, say, well, maybe just one coach. And that was one of those ideas when it first came along. A woman named Linda Salma was doing it in Texas, and it was horrible blasphemy until it started working, and it was kind of considered a pretty good idea. And so we had this one coach model, and then we had one coach and a child specialist, and then people started thinking, well, we can sometimes merge those ideas. And we have one mental health professional on a team. And as we've gone along, what is working collaborative law now is what I call flexible teaming. You pick the team as you go along, deciding what team is needed for each family. And as it becomes flexible, it is growing more. But there's always a tendency to rush to orthodoxy, to say, okay, I've got the one way of doing it, the one way of building teams. And that had slowed collaborative down a little bit. Now, beyond that, the other thing with collaborative, and it's grown in family law in ways that have amazed me. I wake up almost every morning and get surprised when I think of this one man who started this movement that's grown all over the world. And yet it hasn't yet penetrated as much as it can in other areas. But there's actually a really strong, strong group of really talented individuals, including David Hoffman, who teaches at Harvard Law School, who are really working hard to evolve collaborative practice in various other areas of law. Now, the areas where it's starting to take root are in probate areas, where there are probate disputes, where there's family issues, sometimes employment issues. Medical malpractice is really close to making a big breakthrough in that, where people value the privacy of hiring people that'll resolve their issue outside the court system. So if you work outside of family law and you're interested in collaborative practice, I really encourage you to take a second look and email me. I can get you names of contact people who are really evolving civil collaborative practice, because what it does more than any other method, it redefines the role of the advocate in a way that is healthy for folks, that allows people to think differently. And I think when I talk to people about their process choices, and it's true in family law, and I think it's true in many other areas as well, what I hear are two things about a process choice. One, I hear them telling me to some degree, if I talk to them long enough, they will be telling me they want the process to be amicable. And they want it to be amicable, especially if there's children involved. They don't want their children hurt by the process. But even if there aren't children, the expense of having a nasty divorce is hard, the emotional cost, the health cost, I mean, we have the health issues with this, is enormous. So most people want it to be amicable, but at the same time, they want some sense of feeling protected, and they feel like these are contrary things. They say, well, I want it to be amicable, but I don't want to reach an agreement that I'm going to regret. And so how do we balance those? Because they think it's all or nothing. They think it's, well, either keep it amicable and keep the lawyers out of the room and we'll just take our chances, or you lawyer up and it turns into this big nasty process. They don't know that there's an opportunity to balance amicability and protection. And people in this room, in this group, get to teach them that there is that possibility. There is good legal counsel that can help them, that can advocate for them in a way that is different. One of the problems in our culture is that we think that advocacy means argument. We think advocacy, when you talk about an advocate, we immediately think of argument. There was a wonderful book written years ago by Deborah Tiannan called The Argument Culture. Well, we just think, when you say, well, I want to advocate, you think I'm going to argue. Now, we never stop and think that of the ways of getting what we want, argument is almost certainly proven to be the least effective tool. Almost never works. Especially, I mean, it can arguably work in front of a judge if you're saying, oh, the judge is trying to figure out if the light was red or green because the judge hasn't made up his or her mind. But if you're talking to your spouse or your business colleague or somebody who's made up their mind, the chance of argument working to change their mind is almost zero. I mean, clients will come into me all the time and say, well, I want you to argue this point, argue that point. And I get it. It's an emotional reaction. But I'll say to them, well, how many times have you had arguments in your married life? And they'll say, well, 2,000, 5,000, 10,000. Well, how many times has he changed his mind? You know, zero or one or two. Okay. So you've got a strategy that works one in 10,000 times. Okay. Well, are you open to other ideas? Because if the idea is getting people to yes, and that's an interest-based bargaining piece, this is all about getting people to yes, argument is one of the least effective tools. Good advocates know that. The people in this room know that, but the clients don't. And so that's, you know, becoming relevant again, it means getting the aligned professionals, getting the advocates to understand we have better tools than argument. We have better things to help you. And in a divorce case, it's easier for me to see because I say, look, if I'm representing wife and husbands across the other, look, my job is to help you meet your interests, things that are the most important to you. That means I've got to understand those interests, and I've got to get him to say yes. Now, that means you want me as your advocate because you want someone who's a friend at the table. And it's perfectly understandable why they would want a friend at the table. It's a big, scary place. But just because I'm your friend doesn't mean I'm his enemy. In fact, I can be a much better friend if I'm treating this person with respect and understanding. Now, that happens in a divorce world, but also happens in the business world and other places. Strong, smart advocacy isn't about disrespecting people or creating enemies or making arguments. It's about being smarter than that, and it's about finding common interests. And I mentioned I'd talk about interest-based bargaining. That's the whole idea behind this. Rather than locking into positions, we look for the common interests. And so if I'm going to get this spouse to say yes, I got to figure out what he cares about that my client also cares about. When divorce is a little bit easier, you start by saying, well, they want the kids to be healthy. They want the kids to have a good relationship with mother and their father. They want to be left out of the conflict. They want financial stability in both homes. These are larger interests. If you get them talking about the interests they have in common, then argument becomes unnecessary. It becomes a creative problem-solving tool, trying to find the common interests and how to maximize those. That's what we're good at doing. That's what good advocates really do. And when the public starts to learn that that's the kind of advocacy that we're behind, they're more likely to go back to embracing the relevance that lawyers can have and advocates can have in this system. And so the other two quick things, so that's there's the neutrals, there's the aligned professionals, and I want to touch on the interdisciplinary part of this, because I think in all of our professions, understanding when to bring in people with other disciplines, either as neutrals or aligned people, but normally as neutrals, is part of the growth as well. And that's grown a lot in collaborative, but it's grown in all of our other areas as well, certainly in other, in traditional divorce, but you're seeing more and more interdisciplinary work being done. And that's not necessarily moving lawyers to a back seat. I think it's helping smart lawyers get better outcomes for their clients. And then the last piece, before I kind of get through some of the where we are today part, is just understanding unbundling. As I said, I want to explain what unbundling means. So some of you may be a little bit familiar with that, but I want to help you understand it, is that the traditional idea was that when you went in and retained a lawyer, you signed a retainer agreement, and that lawyer represented you for all things, essentially, all things related to your case. The gathering information from you, the getting discovery from your spouse, the research, the negotiation, the drafting, going to court if necessary, all those things are going to be done by the lawyer. It was all part of one package. Well, they say we've got kind of a smarter consumer base now, because some of them are saying, well, I don't want to have to hire you to do all those things. I need some of those things, but not all those things. I need your advice, I may need your drafting, but I can gather my own information. I can get my spouse to give all the information that we need. Or I'm going to even go into court myself, but I want you to advise me about what it would be to go to court. So they're choosing sort of a la carte what things they want me to do and what things they don't. It's the no idea of unbundled service. Now again, for a lot of people it's scary because they think, well, how do I differentiate what exactly I'm being asked to do versus what they might expect me to do? Well, unbundling is something you have to do with very great care. You need to be very clear about what they're being asked to do and what you're not. But I assure you, more and more clients are going to be looking for unbundled legal services as they go forward. As smart consumers, they want to get the best part of our legal minds and not do the parts that they feel can be done elsewhere. So where does that leave us today? What the last parts I want to cover is, where are we today with all of this, and what are the top, I'm going to make the top 10 things that you all can be thinking about that I think are going to make a difference in the future of their practice. So we're in this environment where we've got neutrals, we've got lawyers with some of the image issues. We have the other trend I hadn't talked about enough, and I'll talk about it some with the 10 things we can do, is that what is growing, the other great trend is throughout all of our business and legal world is a rise in self-awareness. You know, I was talking about Tom about yoga, about mindfulness, things that people used to think was way out on the cutting edge, way loose stuff. Now businesses and prisons and corporations and law firms are saying, wait a minute, this stuff really works. Taking care of yourself, being healthy, being mindful. It's not that peace within, peace without. I mean, bringing a better self is no longer flaky talk. It's talking about this is real, this is real stuff, folks. And so that's an enormous thing in terms of us who want to try that new level of advocacy, because we now have data that show this works. And this works in all of our areas. And so that's growing with all of this. I'm going to skip to the 10 things that I think are going to help each of us to think about it. If even one of the 10 applies to you, that I would recommend for people to think about where is your place in this future world? Where do you, as this changing climate happens, what can I do better that's going to make me a better practitioner? And I say that literally. I've been doing this for 40 years and studying this for 40 years, and I'm trying to get better at it every day. This is tricky work, and it's a much harder than learning how to argue and argue cases. I was great at that. I knew how to do that instinctively. This skill takes a lot more understanding and thinking. But the first piece of this, I think the number one skill is learn how to listen for enlightened interest. Enlightened interest. Going back to the interest-based bargaining with all of our clients, whatever skill we can get in learning how to listen for enlightened interest. Now, enlightened interest is actually a Pauline Tesler word, one of our collaborative trainers, because, and especially in family law, but I think in other areas too where emotions run high, what clients say they want may not be what they really want. You know, classic issue in a divorce case, I'm so mad at him, I want his head on a platter. Okay, I get that. But the next day they're saying, okay, but I'm concerned about my kids, and this is the father of my children, and I want them to have a good relationship with their dad. Who do I represent? Do I represent the person who really wants a respectful relationship with the father and their children, or the one who wants the head on their platter? Well, of course, yeah, I mean, listening for an enlightened self-interest. And I always measure by saying, what are the things that 10 years from today they're going to tell me really mattered? Not the urgent things, not the things that are worrying them today, but the things that really matter in the deepest heart. Listening to those issues and understanding that is the first piece, I think, for the new ADR practitioner. The other piece is that with the neutrals, whatever your role is, whether as a neutral or as an aligned professional, understanding how all these roles work as neutral work and be able to find them with clarity in language that people understand is an increasing skill. And I realize sometimes that one of the other great new movements is that cases aren't just coming into the legal door now. I know in divorce law and other areas, they're coming in through other doors. They're coming in through the mental health door. They're coming in through people like Tricia in the financial area. And whatever door they come in on, it becomes our responsibility to explain in just real human terms what this means. And it's really difficult because I use these terms all the time, and I'll talk to groups and they'll be, oh, I loved that guy that said he was talking all about arbitration and how to work in my divorce. I mean, they have no idea what these terms are. Arbitration, mediation, collaboration, they're just words to them. Eventually they come to understand these things, but we have to kind of find what are terms that they'll understand. It's really a matter of saying who's going to be in the room and what is their role? What is their background? Are they on your side or are they neutral? Are they have a background of this or that? What are the functions? What are they going to be asked to do? And then we have to give them labels so that they understand what choices they're making, but we need to get skilled at describing that in an acceptable and clear manner. The more we do that, the more we will rise in the world. Similarly with advocacy, we need to come up with new ways to describe the advocates of the future. Now, maybe we don't even use the word advocacy. I'm using advocate because it's just a shorthand for me. I don't mind that term. But the idea of somebody who's on your side that isn't going to make a mess of things. I mean, we have a big job to do that, and we're learning from each other. We need to find better language for doing that. I think once we do that, once we get an understanding of that kind of advocacy, then I think the marriage between good neutrals and good advocates will really explode. I think right now we have the rise of neutrals, which is wonderful, but the fall of advocacy, of the really good, not just the bad advocacy, but the good advocacy. I think once we get it better at explaining these, we'll see more harmony, because I think people do need that balance. And it's interesting, because I always think people need a friend at the table, and a good friend at the table isn't just gonna argue for you. Sometimes a friend at the table is gonna tell you what you aren't seeing. In fact, what good lawyers do is tell you what you need to hear, not what you wanna hear. And sometimes as a mediator, I can't do that. But as a husband's lawyer or the wife's lawyer, I can help them see stuff that they aren't seeing. And that's, having that friend at the table combined with good neutrals is a wonderful thing when we learn how to understand that. The fourth thing, and I think the thing that will make us great ADR advocates, ABR professionals going forward, is self-awareness. And doing work, whether it's yoga or meditation or just being aware of what we bring to the table. That whole peace within, peace out without, that Tom says is just exactly at it. I mean, as I strive to get better as a collaborative professional and as a mediator, that's the biggest part of my work. who I bring to the table. I mean, most of the skill set I can describe in my sleep, but what I bring to the table has to do with whether I've calmed myself down and out, whether I can, you know, bring the right presence so I'm not taking on the problem. The more skilled I get at that, the better advocate I am, the better mediator I am. And then the other piece of this, again, is authenticity and passion. I mean, find, if this is something you're passionate about, if ADR work is, and I realize, I mean, this is an ADR group, most people here are passionate about this, but, you know, some people more than others. Some people might say, well, I want to dabble in this a little bit, but I mostly want a traditional practice. No great sin in that. You're not going to go to some ADR hell if that's how you feel. That's okay. but if you really, really want to do this work, if you really want peacemaking work, it's there for you. I know it's there in family and other areas, but it's only there if you're passionate about it. I know lots of people who have built practices of their dreams, including me and many of the people in this room. None of them got there easily. They got there through many, many meetings like this. They were passionate about it. They loved doing it. But at this point, there aren't any shortcuts to this. If you really want to do this work, you have to spend a lot of time hanging out with people like this in rooms like this. But if you love doing it, you won't mind doing that, and you'll build that practice. The other piece, number six item, is that finding peace among the peacemakers. Because it is, much as I love being around the mediation and collaborative community, ADR community, some of the most wonderful people I've ever met, we're human beings, and we get in the side rooms and we say, oh, this person does it all wrong. And we get the usual infighting and stuff. It's not that we can't disagree, we can absolutely disagree, but we need to model the peace that we're asking our clients to do, which is, okay, you can disagree with other ADR people, nothing wrong with that, but let's find a way to find common ground and build on our common understanding. That's a much bigger problem than people realize. There's a lot of infighting in the mediation and collaborative community. That's human nature, but yet we're capable of rising above that. The next one is just context, having an understanding of where the mutuals go, where the neutrals fit in and the advocates fit in. What I'm really in favor of is a client-centered process. And a client-centered process means we will mix and match and we will put the pieces together as we see, as the client needs them. My kind of mantra that I put on my business card is informed decisions, better outcomes. And it means two things. One, what I believe in more than anything is that my client deserves to be able to make an informed decision, which means he or she, or couples, and maybe with couples, need to really understand the, and if they really understand things, and that means not hiring Ron Oski, that's fine. I can sleep well at night if they understood their choices. What is sad is hearing about people who go through a scorched earth divorce or a bad legal dispute of some sort, and nobody ever explained their choices. To me, that's equivalent of somebody going through surgery and a doctor never told them they could have resolved it through health issues and or through diet and exercise, which actually happens. But the idea is that they have to understand and explain to people their choices. And then the better outcomes part of it is that we are not selling bad outcomes. Civility is not weakness. And that's the other hard messaging thing. I think we're kind of branded as the nice people out there, but I want to get something done, I better hire the person with the sharp elbows. That's the old way of thinking. We can show, and our research is showing, we're getting better outcomes using these tools, but we need to help people understand we're not about just being nice to be nice. We're about being nice because in many cases it works. Respect works, civility works, and working on common interests works. Next item is interest-based negotiation. Learn as much as you can about what interest-based really looks like and how to prioritize that. We're still just beginning to learn what that means and how to do that well. Number nine, it's that to be able to explain all these options in a credible way. I often, when a client comes to my office, I will explain the choices they need to make. Even litigate, I mean, I'm not anti-litigation in a sense. Sometimes people need to litigate. There are times you're in a situation where you have to, and there are people who do that honorably. And I want to describe the choices in a way so if my best friend who litigates was sitting there, he or she would not feel like I was unfair to their process. Because I'm certainly asking that of them. I want them to, when their client says, what about collaborative? I want them to say, look, I don't happen to do that, but but there are people that do it well, and you can go talk to these people. You know, the respectable thing, the integrity, is to describe all processes with integrity, and I think we need to thrive as a community, and we need to connect better with our litigation colleagues and be able to do that. That, you talk about ethics, and there's the ethic part, that's the ethical standard, to describe responsibly all the choices in a way that isn't the Ron way or the Lisa way, but the way that the clients need to hear about it. And then, let's see. What
can't read my writing on the next pencil.
I think this was I kind of overlapped with the other one. The idea that civility is not weakness, and understanding that, I mean, this came out of the John Kennedy speech that, you know, he in his first inaugural, he said, we must understand that civility is not weakness, and sincerity is always subject to verification. And I always kind of keep that in my mind, because I think we as a culture think that the way to get things done is to be uncivil, and most of our life experiences teach us other than that, and we need to be better teachers and stewards of that. And before I open up the questions then, I wanted to, a couple of you, one of the people said, well, how do you get the word out about ADR practice? And in fact, this is the only marketing piece I'm going to do because how to build a collaborative practice or how to build a mediation practice, ADR practice, is a whole separate seminar, and everybody's interested in ADR spent a lot of time doing that because it is. Yeah, you don't want to have to miss a meal. You want to be able to get people showing up at your door, but it's still, even 40 years down the road, still relatively new to people. For me, who I hate marketing, I don't want to go out to the public and say, I'm a great media, I'm a great this or that. I want them to know me as a person. And so what I do a couple of things. One, I do a blog just about me as a person. But then a few months ago, I decided, one of the things, I believe in relationships. One of the reasons I got into divorce practice, I've been married 40 years. My wife is back at the end of the room, and I'm not here because I want people to get divorced. But I'm here because I believe in relationships, and I try to teach that with our kids who are now getting married and going through stuff. And we do it, and I believe in conversation as a centerpiece of that. So I said, well, why don't you create a giveaway, get conversation cards for people to have better conversations, just to stir up and remind them to have deeper conversations. So I created these, and I started giving around to people, and, you know, it kind of says, is it crazy for a divorce lawyer to try to help couples stay connected? We don't think so, and blah, 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 goes on and on. But then there's questions in there, so I give them out to people, and one of the local media people, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, heard about it, because, you know, the idea of lawyers being nice is sort of like one of those man bites dog stories. It seems reversed to them. And so they wrote a nice story about it, and I got, like, thousands of requests, and they're doing another story next week. But it's just the idea of let people know who you are and what you care about. Be authentic to your voice and your message, and people will show up more so than trying to market the other way. So with that, I left a few minutes here for questions. I realize we're wrapping up at 1. Any questions that I can give anybody?
Can we have you go up to Congress and keep
them on? No, but I mean that the one of the pieces I was going to mention, right, because I had in my notes, is that one of the things as peacemakers that we need to do beyond Congress and even in our own living rooms now, the amount of division among us politically, and I realize ADR groups tend to bring the blue side of the world, so maybe it's all blue world, we're two blue people traveling with the reddest people in the world, and we're living, or not the reddest people in the world, but they're red, but we love them. Well, it's scary there, but we love them. They're dear people, but we're living in a culture where we can't talk to each other anymore. I mean, and so I think we need to be the stewards of that conversation. How do we have a civil conversation among conservatives and liberals? If we can't do that, then how do we expect our clients to do any better than that? There's a great website called betterangels.org. Started by a colleague of ours who's their idea, how do we have conversations among liberals and conservatives that are respectful without trying to change anybody's mind? If we can get back to that, then maybe Congress will follow suit. You know, I mean, that's, you know, we've got to lead from these. So anyhow, so are there any other things?
You made a quote by, I think it was Lester Thoreau. Yeah, economist.
Yeah, Thoreau. There were a couple of references. One is that his statement was that if we are relying upon, if we're giving out information, that in the information age we're not likely to have much of a living because information is going to be cheap. You know, people get information now. Sometimes it's unreliable information, but they think they know what's out there. But what is valuable is judgment. They can't quantify judgment. And when I look at my hourly rate, and I was talking at lunch the other day, I mean, I charge $3.30 an hour, which is probably typical for a Minnesota divorce lawyer of my age, which isn't a big number. But I grew up working on a farm for $2 an hour. So when sometimes I listen, I was like, that's crazy. $3.30 an hour for talking to people, that's nuts. And yet when I look at what I pay when the divorce is over and the monthly payment, no, they really got good value. I feel like they really do. But it's charging by the hour is kind of a crazy way to do things. And we're working with flat fee stuff. But I think my main thing is what I tell clients now is, look, if you're watching, most of my work isn't going to be worth $10 or $20 an hour. But when you're at that key moment, when you're trying to exercise judgment, that may impact the well-being of your children or your financial life, or may cost, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, it can be invaluable. They are paying for judgment. And I do the same thing, whether it's my car mechanic or my doctor, or my lawyer, I find somebody I trust and I pay for his or her judgment. That's what they're paying for. And I think that's the one part they're never going to be able to digitize, is good judgment and relationships. I mean, how do people find out you have good judgment? They sit across the table from you and they talk with you. I'm not against the information age, but relationships still matter and judgment still matters. So that's the main thing I wanted from Lester Thoreau. So.
And you were also talking about a Minnesota attorney who was a prominent mediator, and you didn't say the name.
Oh, Dan Simon. He's a transformative. He's on that cutting edge, and Dan drives people crazy because he's so militant about it. He is just righteous about transformative, but he does it well. But I just thought of an example of, and I love that Dan is wonderful at what he does, but he does not necessarily appreciate what other folks are doing. But he's an example of a good transformative mediator.
No agenda, no, he has absolutely nothing vested in the outcomes.
It's
just like the opposite of evaluative.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's even beyond, like I say, facilitate. Most mediation trainings, if you're involved in mediation training, they train in facilitative, and then we get out and we do mostly facilitative, but then we move a little bit down to continuum. I mean, most mediators do a facilitative process with gentle nudges up the continuum.
There's just
the practical issues. But I think, again, it's a matter of informed decision making. Yeah. Are you interested in having me have that role? If so, here's what it would look like. And there's no right or wrong. It's quite different from Dan. I think the highest order is if you can help people make their own decisions, but not everybody's capable of that. Mm-hmm. So. Yes?
Do you see these peacemaker and collaborative divorce cases devolve into those kind of scorched earth cases still from time to time? If you do, what do you do in those?
Sometimes it is true. I mean, I've done about 750 collaborative divorces now. 95% of them have settled within the collaborative process. 5% of them fell out. That was sort of the big fear. It's like, oh, if you do collaborative, they're going to have to start over with lawyers. Well, the number of people switching lawyers in my current practice is no greater than they switch lawyers in my other practice. So it's not been as big a problem. However, even of the 95% settled, some of them aren't that. I mean, I get hard cases. And I would say, some of them just settle. We find a way to break the impasse. We might take them to somebody evaluative and say, that will. So I would say what the beauty of collaborative is that we try to get better outcomes. I always feel like my thing is I want to give them an opportunity for a better outcome. What they do with that opportunity is up to them. I would say about 2/3 of my settled cases, they got something that I didn't see in regular practice. Sometimes they get amazing things. I've seen settlements that literally bring tears to my eyes. But 1/3 of the time, they just settled the case. And that's something, if you're new to collaborative, people, you go to these training, they go, every case is going to be just wonderful. Well, no, and every case isn't wonderful. Some of them are hard. Overall,
it's
they're
not
better.
Kumbaya.
Yeah.
You get
some that it goes really great. But you have more tools at my disposal. And I get some really get angry people say, okay, and you've got mental health professionals, other people, and say, okay, what do we do with that anger? And it's not that we can suppress that, but we can hopefully take it somewhere else. And I was saying the other day, divorce law is easy except for the emotion, which is sort of like saying swimming is easy except for the water. It's all emotion. And I don't blame people for the emotion. It's just that it affects their judgment. And my job is to help them think about how that emotion is affecting their judgment in a way they might regret. Sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. But that's the part from Stu Webb, too. It's like, it's not my case. All I can do is give them an opportunity. If they don't do it, I got to let go of that.
So, Ron, in a profession, legal profession in particular, that has highest suicide rate, the highest alcoholism and drug abuse rates, 50% burnout rate in terms of young lawyers that within a 5-year period choosing to go into rock music or some
computer programming
or what have you. Can you speak a little? I know you touched upon it and we talked about this at lunch yesterday, but can you speak to the benefits to the practitioner from a spiritual, from a health, psychological, etc. point of view?
Absolutely. Thank you, because that is absolutely, and we were talking about that, some in the context of the law school, because I think law students are starting to have wellness weeks, and one of the things our collaborative group is going to go to the wellness week at one of our law schools, because lawyers who go to law school are reading these things saying, look, lawyers are miserable, why am I going to law school? Well, some are and some aren't. And I would tell people who go to law school, look, go to the office, visit the office of lawyers, and even, and get a sense for you when you're there, what it seems like their life is like. And I think if they hung out at our office and at our collaborative center, and I forgot to talk about the collaborative center, we've got this center of all sorts of interdisciplinary professionals, you find people are happy. There's a different slice, which is not true. So the idea of wellness, I mean, so one of the things that ought to attract both new practitioners and hopefully even experienced practitioners to ADR methods shouldn't be just your client's well-being, which is but our own well-being. It is a healthy, much, much healthier way to practice. Two of our best collaborative practitioners are people who defected from good corporate practice. One of them was Ivy League educated, was working with one of the biggest firms in town, intellectual property law, and she got criticized by, you know, at the end of the week, she wrote, "Have a good weekend," to the other lawyer, and her senior partner got on her like crazy. "You don't say have a good weekend to your..." She's like, "I can't live in that world." And so she gave it all up. She built a collaborative family law practice from scratch, from zero. She's one of the best collaborative family law practitioners I know, and is happier for that. She couldn't live in an environment. That's an exaggeration. Most law firms will say, "Look, we don't have it that heavy." But you're in an environment where you can't say, "Have a good weekend," to the other attorney. That's going to wear on you. You know, that's not the kind of life you want to live. I think wellness among professionals is a huge, huge piece. And life balance, all these things. And again, a third of what the ADR world does is bring you in rooms like this, which felt different than the Bar Association functions I went to early on in my practice. You know, rooms of people that care about how they feel in life and care about the deeper things. I did mention that collaborative center. We had, as interdisciplinary grew, we did start this center because the idea is, if I'm going to hire 3 or 4 different professionals all over the city, it's going to be a little crazy. We thought, wouldn't it be nice if we all office in the same building? So we started a space 15 years ago with about 5,000 square feet, and it went so well it's grown to 23,000 square feet. Now, only about 75% of that is people who do collaborative or ADR and mediation. The rest of it is other things, but it's still a lot of folks. I do mostly team cases of 4 professionals that are almost always in the building right across the hall, and it's really a neat environment. And so it's that doesn't have to exist everywhere, but it's a good example of how we can team up with other professionals and give clients the best of all worlds. And so, anything else? Yes.
Here I go.
Well, this will be the last question.
Last question
for
me?
Yeah. You got a pitch count. <isn't it? laughs>
So just ask the question.
Yeah, I'm being invalidated. Yeah.
So I noticed that you seem very comfortable using the term peacemaker and peace builder rather than specifically just talking about mediators and arbitrators and all the other professional personalities that are involved. In your navigation forward, do you foresee today that we might move from alternative dispute resolution to appropriate dispute resolution?
Interesting. No, that's a great, maybe. I think looking at better languaging is all so new that I really think we need to look at our language. And, when I'm using peacemaker, I'm mostly talking about out-of-court practice, kind of borrows from Woody Mostyn's training, where people that do practices that are mostly mediation and collaborative and out-of-court. But I like getting fresher words. Again, an alternate maybe doesn't say it fully, but that's a key part of it. How do we get better language that the public understands? Because I think we've started, and it's all so new, that we just used language that we understood, but I'm not sure how they understand it. And I'd love to think better about how our public wants to hear about us. Well, again, thank you all very much.
Thank
it's been an honor to be here. If any of you are interested in the materials, and I may write up some stuff, give me an email, a card, and I'll send you an email with some things. So happy to do that.
Thanks again, everyone, for coming. So, there's still some snacks. I think we have the room until about 1:30. If you came in later.